Hello, everybody. You're listening to Aaron Torkelson Weber and Karen Hooper's review of Hunter Davies, The Beatles, The Authorized Biography. We hope you enjoy it. So welcome, Aaron, to another of our podcasts reviewing Beatles biography. How are you today?
Just fine. Ready to talk some shop.
Okay. Today we're going to be reviewing Hunter Davies' book, The Beatles, The Authorized Biography, that was originally published in 1968. Excuse me. And there have been subsequent editions from that period right into the 90s. And I think the difference in all of those editions is just that there were different intros that he wrote to kind of scope out how he approached the book and any sort of new information, I think, that he gleaned in the ensuing years. But I read the way back when, not to date myself, but I read the original book in 1968 when I was a wee lass. And Aaron, which one do you think you read, or did you read more editions than just the original?
Well, for my book, I read the 1968 edition. I believe I read a 1982, 1983, I would have to nail it down, okay, edition. And I read a later 1990s edition. And the reason I did that is, with all the major sources in Beatles historiography, something that had multiple editions, something like a Shout or an Authorized Biography or a Revolution in the Head, I wanted to read all the editions to see what changes had been made.
Right.
Or if any changes had been made.
Yeah, yeah. Because I'm just looking at my notes here, and I think the one, when I read it again just recently for this podcast, I read the 1996 edition, which contained the intro from 1985 mm-hmm. and the 1996 intro. So he kind of built on previous editions as he gathered more information. That kind of scoped out his project, which is kind of interesting. Anyway, we'll start with the backstory about Hunter Davies, just for people who may not know much about him. He was born in 1936 in Carlisle, England, so roughly the same age as the Beatles. And he describes Carlisle as being even more north than Liverpool. So he feels a certain affinity toward the Beatles in terms of, you know, background and attitudes and, you know, being the same age and stuff. He grew up in a council house, as did Paul. And he, I think, started out as a journalist or a reporter and said that he felt a little bit out of his element because the other reporters were older men and he felt very class conscious because they came from a whole different kind of world than he did. So he meets Paul, I'm not entirely sure how, but he meets Paul in 1996.
I can clarify.
Sorry, 1966. Sorry, 1966, yeah. When he got an interview with him.
I can clarify that a little bit in that he, to my understanding, heard Eleanor Rigby. And upon hearing Eleanor Rigby, he became intrigued enough that he wanted to interview Paul. He wanted to talk to the Beatles.
Interesting. Okay. All right. So 1996, right? He hears the song and he wants to talk to Paul, or to the Beatles. And I guess, I don't know how he nailed Paul, because Paul he thought was the author or the writer of the song. That's where he directed his interest.
I believe so. Well, again, Paul sings the song. So old pattern of the primary author being the lead singer is something that was relatively well known even in that time period.
Right, right. And he says that at that time, the only two books he ever read about the Beatles, the only, I guess, biographies that he read were Billy Sheppard's book. I think it's the title is The True Story of the Beatles. It was written like in early 64. And the Michael Braun book, which I think is called Love Me Do. In Progress or something, Love Me Do. And those are the two biographies that he read. And he thought that those books were really limited in scope and wanted to do a fuller biography. So he approached Paul, who told him that he needed to ask Brian, and he helped Hunter Davies draft a letter. So Davies did that, and I guess Brian, of course, gave him permission, and he began work on the book in January of 1967, and he explained that in one of his introductions in the subsequent editions that he began with Ringo because he kind of used Ringo as kind of like the key informant. He started there because he thought Ringo would be the easiest person to interview, and thinking and expressing the view that sometimes if you have to review or want to interview multiple people and associates, you know, start with the person who can kind of grease the wheels for all the subsequent interviews. So that's what he did. And he thought that then the interview with Ringo would go well and therefore positively shape the rest of the interviews with the Beatles. And apparently it did. So let's see. He's also said that Hunter Davies said that he really wanted to speak to the parents of like Ringo and Freddie Lennon, for Ringo's father and Freddie Lennon, for example, thought that was a real gap in sort of in the Beatles' history where the other biographies didn't attempt to do that, or maybe attempted and didn't succeed. But he wanted to reach out to Ringo's real father and Freddie Lennon. And I think I'm going through my notes here. I think he managed to talk to Freddie Lennon, but that was really late in the process. In the book, he kind of snuck it in at the end, and the book almost didn't get published without that interview in there. Mm-hmm. That Ringo's real father, I don't remember whether he succeeded in securing that interview or not, but those are the two people that he really wanted to interview because they had, you know, there was sort of a missing piece there around their kind of perceptions. He mm-hmm. said he got to know the parents really well of all the Beatles and had a sort of kind of a beat on them in terms of how they adapted to their children's fame. He said that he thought Jim McCartney was supportive and comfortable with the Paul's fame, but tended to avoid the limelight compared to George's mom, who was almost a professional Beatle parent, a very enthusiastic, involved parent, answers fan mail and all that stuff. Contrast that to Ringo's parents, his mother and stepdad, who were kind of nervous and uncomfortable, although very happy for their son, but not entirely comfortable sort of being in the associated limelight. And Mimi was in a way kind of avoidant of John's fame. He said favoring instead her memory of him as this little boy in this perfect childhood. And subsequently you find out that through Hunter Davies' writings that Mimi was very resistant to a lot of the things that John said in the biography during his interview with Davies. And Davies had to go over line by line by line by line to ensure that she was okay with some of the stuff. He had to take stuff out. And I guess John was kind of wringing his hands at his end, not wanting to get Mimi upset. So Mimi was a bit of a character around this whole kind of biography writing. In terms of how he did the research, he not only interviewed the primary players and their associates, he spent a lot of personal time, you know, with their acquaintances, and he got, for example, old copies of the Mercy Beat, copies of their, I guess, tape recordings of their early performances, and other kinds of documents which he thought could independently confirm or clarify their story. And as an example, he said that he went to Hamburg and visited all the clubs the Beatles performed in, and I don't remember which club it was, but he determined that there was one club he determined that there were three Hamburg tours when John said there were two and Paul said there were four. So even in writing basic information like that, the memories of the participants are kind of not necessarily consistent. So he went to Hamburg to kind of scope that out. Said the first version of the 1968 book was in two volumes. Then he reduced it by 50% by eliminating, you know, material and photos and all the documents. And so they talked a bit about how he had to sort of go about securing, you know, the rights to write an authorized biography. So he had to get permission from all the main characters, and says that's where his trouble began. First, he let the individual Beatles read the draft and had written the contract to enable them to change any factual errors. But only Paul found minor factual errors, and the rest of the Beatles were okay with it, except George, who apparently was a little bit peeved because there wasn't more information about his pursuit of Indian music. But Davis didn't feel like that was really an error of the book. But he did what he asked, what George asked, but it didn't add any length to the book, so that was fine. And then Davis receives a letter from John, who, as we talked a bit earlier about Mimi having a bit of a fit over what John said to Davies about his upbringing. And so John writes Hunter Davies and says he's really worried about Mimi. And he's also concerned about his sisters because John made remarks about Bobby Dinkins, his mother's lover or partner, I should say. And I guess he made some disparaging comments in there about Dinkins and was concerned that his sisters would feel kind of hurt by it. So there was this kind of boiling in the soup, you know, as Davies is trying to sort of publish this book. And as I said earlier, he had to go with Mimi and meet her and go line by line in the book and remove any lines that she didn't like or rewrite them in a way that she did. And the line in the book, which is totally Mimi's, was that John was, quote, happy as the day was long. That was a quote he had to put in the book to sort of, you know, cap off the discussion about John's childhood. And after this, other incidental players kind of had their two cents. By then, Brian Epstein had died, and his mother, Queenie Epstein, was in charge of Brian's estate, and Davies was technically beholden to her for clearance to get the book published. So Davies ended up having to steer clear of any sort of mention of Brian's sex life and the possibility of Brian being gay. So that had to be kind of whitewashed. And as I said, I think too that he met Freddie Lennon as the book was going to print and was, you know, able to put a few, you know, to get Freddie's memories about some of the key events in John's life that he was able to include in the book. Let me see here. I just wanted to add, so those are my notes about the book and about Hunter Davies, but my impression of the book is a little bit, or feelings about the book is a little bit biased because all the other books that we've read are books that were written kind of, you know, in the 90s or 80s or whatever, you know, after the Beatles broke up, basically, and they're more retrospective, where this is a book that I read when it was published, and it was written while the Beatles were together, as was the other two books, Braun's book and Billy Shepherd's book. So it's a little bit different in that respect, I think. But anyway, I'll turn it over to you, Aaron, and I'll let you take it from there.
Okay. And your discussion, I thought, of the editing that Davies had to allow from John, from George, from Mimi, Queenie, etc., I think is a good jumping off point because, and this is just my personal evaluation, I've always had issues with authorized history because I go into it knowing that there's always going to be a certain amount of smoke and mirrors. And the question is simply how much smoke and how many mirrors. So having said that, Davies has consistently defended the vast majority of the material in the authorized biography and will delve more into the importance and the reputation of the authorized biography a little later on. But to start off with, again, one of the major categories that we go through in regards to primary source versus secondary source, the authorized biography is slightly complicated because there is so much primary source material in it, because we have so many direct quotes from obviously all of the Beatles, but also individuals associated with their lives and their art, George Martin, etc. But it's a biography. It's not a autobiography. So it is a secondary source. Again, if you're classifying it according to historical methods, if you're putting it on the shelf in the library. But it is one that contains an enormous amount of primary source material. So one of the issues that I have when I'm looking at the authorized biography, not just in addition to the issue of the edits, but also one of the things that really grips my attention is how much time that Davies spent researching it, again, to his credit, as you mentioned, finding documentation, going through old newspapers. Now, we know there are some things, unfortunately, that Davies took people's words for. This is where we get the origin of the infamous false story of Mimi Smith dodging bombs on her way to the hospital in order to warn John Lennon. But there are other things that he did not take at face value, such as the hamburger trips, as you discussed. But that element of how much time he spends with the Beatles, I think, is something that can get overlooked. And again, going through the categories, trying to consider, okay, what are similar works in Beatles historiography to this particular work? And there are different elements that go in there. Number one, Davies is a journalist, and that certainly doesn't set him apart in terms of authorship in Beatles historiography. The vast majority of the authors that we were dealing with, particularly in the first wave, were journalists. But what does set it apart is simply the amount of time that he spends with the Beatles, not just interviewing them, but observing them, watching them in their everyday lives, watching them in the studio, spending extensive time with their families, etc. And that really does set him apart. Now, that's something that he is only able to do, again, because of that authorization. So Braun's work, Love Me Do, again, is set in a much narrower scope of time and a very different scope of time, because that's taking place in the early heyday of the touring period. But Davies now, we're dealing with 1966, 1967, and a publication in 1968. So this is the peak of the middle period for the Beatles. So again, trying to find other works that you can compare that are similar to this was rather difficult in a way, because you rarely get that much access and that extensive chronological access in other works in Beatles historiography. One of the things that comes to mind, of course, is the Beatles anthology. But that's also hamstrung because, obviously, John Lennon tragically was not available to participate in the Beatles anthology. Another work that I thought has some similarities to the Beatles authorized biography is McCabe. And that's one where you get McCabe trailing along with Alan Klein, with John, George, and Ringo, observing them in meetings, sometimes in Klein's offices, sometimes in the studio and other areas. So Apple to the Core actually has some similarities to the authorized biography. The difference is McCabe doesn't trail them as long, certainly as Davies did. And again, you've only got three Beatles. The same way that you only have three Beatles in the Beatles anthology. So it's kind of hard to categorize this. The nearest thing I could come up with is Conversations with McCartney, because that first book that we discussed on our podcast, You've got Paul Dunoyer, who again has that similarity like Hunter Davies. He's from the North. The interviews take place over an extensive period of time, and they really delve into deeper issues. But again, that contrast is, it's just one beetle.
Mm-hmm.
So did you have any comments you wanted to make on that, Karen?
Just something kind of popped in my head as you're discussing that, Aaron, and that is one of the elements of when you do social research is being mindful of how your, if you're the researcher, if your presence inherently changes the participation and behavior of the people you're observing, and which is sort of human nature. And not that that would, you know, discount Davies' work and perceptions, but I wonder how much of that is an element. And we don't know, we can't answer that question, but it just popped in my mind that if one is comparing a work like Davies with a work that's done sort of without being so involved with the people you're writing about, sort of how those works would be different in terms of not affecting the behavior of the people that you're observing and writing about, because you're not there.
Right. And Davies does defend that very point in the preface to one of the later editions, where he says the beetles behaved naturally around me.
Right.
Now, obviously, that would be his preferred point of view, because yeah. if they're not behaving naturally around him, then he's not getting the most accurate portrait of them. However, we do have reinforcement for numerous things Davies says from other individuals who were associating with the Beatles at this particular point in time. And that's something I always look for, confirmation. Do we have varying sources saying similar things on certain subjects? And one of the things I always come back to is Davies talks in the authorized biography and in other sources about how among all four Beatles, John found it easiest to get along with Ringo. And part of that was because he didn't see Ringo as a threat. And that is something that you get separately from Pete Shotton.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So yes, there's really no way to know exactly how much Davies' presence altered the Beatles' behavior.
Right.
And the fact that, again, that's one of my issues with authorized biographies.
Right. You know, and the fact that Davies even commented on that, knowing it's a factor, says something.
Yes.
That he could have just not, he was aware enough as a journalist, as a writer, that his presence could be a factor. And to speak to that, however, positively shows that at least he knows that could be a variable. Yeah.
So in terms of categorization, there's really not too much to drill down into with the authorized biography. We already said it's a secondary source, but it's one that contains a significant amount of primary source material and primary source material, as you mentioned, that is not available anywhere else because Davies did such extensive interviews that other people weren't doing in that time period. So it's a secondary source. There are some semi-similar works, but nothing on the scale or the scope of the authorized biography. But in addition to that, one of the elements, obviously, that we have to deal with is narrative. And here's where things really start to interest me, in that my argument is that the authorized biography is the last time all four Beatles speak with the same voice and offer the same narrative. And that narrative, of course, is the Fab Four narrative. It's the first version of Beatles history, the first version we are given, the one that they've been telling since 1963. And that's really what's very interesting to me, because, of course, Davies is published in 1968. And almost instantly, the authorized biography, because of chronology, because of real events unfolding, becomes outdated.
Mm-hmm.
Because here's Davies talking about Paul's relationship with Jane. and talking about John's relationship with Cynthia. And obviously he barely gets in Brian's death, but he doesn't really deal with any of the chaos that emerges afterwards because he can't.
And he commented on that, I think, in other writings, that just like the whole thing imploded right after it was published. And he really did feel that.
So it's very interesting, the role timing, chronological timing takes place in Beatles historiography, because you have some books like Shout that benefit immensely, in this case, from tragic timing. You have other books that essentially see their interpretations sabotaged very quickly by real life events. The Authorized Biography is one of those books. So is Apple to the Core. Because as I've discussed before, Apple to the Core's basic conclusion is, well, it was the Eastmans' fault. Klein's a good manager. And then a year later, Klein is getting fired by John, George, and Ringo. So the Authorized Biography falls into that camp. And I think that's a significant element of the ups and downs of its reputation. Not only that it strongly endorsed all of the major elements of the Fab Four narrative, but that it did so almost immediately upon the significant, I don't want to call it destruction, but serious erosion of that narrative.
Yeah. I kind of wonder just how Davies, had the book been published later, how he would have incorporated, he would have written this whole book that was, you know, kind of really kind of mining the Fab Four narrative or presenting that, and then how he would have handled that as an author.
If it was, yes, considered. If it, yeah, like out of date, like, in 1968, imagine if he had delayed until 1969.
Yeah, if it just took longer, or it just for whatever reason, he would have. That's a huge shift in his whole presentation. Yes.
And so I think that's always been one of the major elements of the reaction to Davies. So one of the things that I did, again, part of the reason I read through all of the different editions, but I also looked at Davies's later works and statements, because obviously that wasn't his final word on the Beatles. And so he's published other books on the Beatles, on the Quarrymen, and he's also published books like the John Lennon Letters, and he has commentary and interpretations in there. And so one of the elements there is that Davies is essentially still arguing the fundamental arguments and the fundamental interpretations in books like the John Lennon Letters, which was published in 2012, that he was arguing in 1968.
Really? Can you give an example?
Well, he has discussion of things like the Lennon-McCartney partnership, and is essentially saying, again, the fundamental aspects of the Fab Four narrative, of how essential they were to each other. You have him talking about the breakup, and there's a very striking quote in the Beatles lyrics. I'm trying to find it right now. Davies in the John Lennon lyrics. I hadn't expected them to splutter and splinter apart over what seemed to the outside world to be petty, piddling, personal and business differences. Dear God, surely they could have worked it out.
Interesting.
I say that and I think of Airplane. Don't call me Shirley.
Wow. You know, when you started to talk about that, I was thinking, well, you know, the Fab Four narrative, his perception of that was based on what he saw, so that was accurate. But how he reviewed the breakup seems really like sort of, you know, a swing and a miss. In a sense that, you know, piddly kind of little problems. It seemed, you know, retrospectively looking back, it was sort of more than just piddly little problems that they couldn't overcome. It was bigger than that.
Right. But it's interesting how, again, his evaluations of George Martin, his evaluations of the Lennon-McCartney partnership, his evaluations of their friendship, all of those things that he's discussing in 1968 are being reinforced in his latter work.
Mm-hmm. But how would that be? I guess what I'm wondering, Aaron, is that would be true of the time, though. Like how, like the fact that what has happened doesn't change or negate what was. So I'm not getting, like, what would he be saying, I guess, instead?
Now. Well, it's complicated because obviously Davies was giving us evidence and a version and a narrative in the authorized biography in 1968, almost immediately saw that version and narrative erode and then overtly criticized by John and Lennon Remembers. Mm-hmm. And so that overt criticism obviously negatively impacted Davies's reputation as a journalist and the reputation and the credibility of the authorized biography. So you're in an interesting position at that point. If you are an author of something like the authorized biography, you can either reassess your interpretation, which again, as long as it's evidence-based reinterpretation, there's nothing wrong with that. Or you look at the evidence again with fresh eyes, and you determine whether your initial assessment was correct. Now, obviously, there's self-interest in here because it is not in Davies's best interest to look at the authorized biography in 2012 and say, oh, yeah, I got everything wrong.
Mm-hmm. I guess my question, though, is what do you think or do you think he got wrong? Like, is there an answer to that question?
You mean in specific factual issues or well, in terms of his interpretation?
In his assessment of, I'm just, the relationship, just pick one thing, the relationship and how he assessed their relationship and their, you know, kind of almost enmeshed relationship and how he could reassess that now, I guess. What would be, like what I'm wondering is whether that, his assessment of it was true at the time. And mm-hmm. It just, you know, so it didn't, what's happened since doesn't negate, it's like a marriage that falls apart. You can say they were wonderful for 20 years and that was true, but then they broke up, you know, so would it be the sort of task potentially of that person to say, or the writer, whoever, to say, well, yeah, the cracks were there. We just didn't see them, you know, that sort of thing. Is that kind of where, would that be the more accurate way of reviewing his information rather than say, just double down on it and say, no, that was true then? Is that, I'm just trying to ferret out kind of where you're at on that.
Well, my evaluation would be more along the issue, again, because we're looking at this in a historiographical sense. Which work would you put more trust in? Which work do you believe is going to give you a more accurate version of events? And see, one of the elements that we always have to deal with the authorized biography is again, because of that overt criticism in Lennon Remembers. Mm-hmm. That damages the authorized biography's reputation. So it's almost pitting Lennon Remembers mm-hmm, versus yes. the authorized biography.
Yeah, against, yeah.
So there are various elements going into that. So I guess to simplify, you're asking yourself the question, which source do I regard as more credible? The authorized biography in 1968 or Lennon Remembers published in 1971? Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that if you choose one, then the other is worthless. That's not right. What I'm saying.
Right, right. Yeah.
So in regards to that, I think that is an interesting comparison because in regards to Lennon Remembers, you have some interesting parallels, again, because you have these extensive interviews. But the Lennon Remembers interview, number one, you only have one Beatle involved, mm-hmm. as opposed to four. Mm-hmm. So Lennon Remembers is much more of a one-man show. Also, it's a much smaller scope of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Winter is not embedded with John Lennon in his life for weeks and months at a time.
Yeah.
And so that matters. And then you add the interesting little nugget that, yes, John denounces the authorized biography and Lennon Remembers, but then John later denounces the importance of Lennon Remembers in successive interviews.
Exactly. It's so circuitous. Like, I was just thinking as you're saying that, you know, in Davey's book, John was very vocal about his relationship with them and how he was so, you know, he needed them. And then he totally renounced that in Lennon Remembers. And then he renounces Lennon Remembers. So, yeah, that's hard to assess, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's one of the, again, fascinating things, certainly about John as a source and, again, about the authorized biography. And I want to make it clear. Mm-hmm. I think it's a reasonable conclusion that Davies has a self-interest in advocating for the narrative that he supported and the interpretations he wrote in 1968. My reading is that he has continued to largely argue that evidence and those narratives up to the present day. And that's one of the things that I find interesting. One of the things that you're supposed to note as an historian when you're dealing with a primary source or a secondary source is consistency.
Mm-hmm.
Do they continue to argue the same version of events, the same interpretation, particularly if they were a witness to numerous events, and Davies was a witness to numerous events. Mm. So that's one of the elements of the authorized biography and Davies' later work that I've always been particularly intrigued by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It came to mind too, a little bit of a tangent, but I was, you know, I remember there being, I don't know if it was on TV or a radio interview, but it was something, it was a confrontation between Davies and Goldman. And it was good guy, bad guy. And in Davies challenging Goldman in terms of, his book and, did he write, was it The Lives of John Lennon? I can't remember the title.
Yes.
Now. And how it was, you know, quite scandalous. And Davies kind of challenging his kind of what he, I don't know, kind of perceived as, or what he called, you know, muckraking kind of journalism. And basically arguing for his narrative against mm-hmm. Goldman's narrative, you know, in that discussion, or probably a whole lot of discussions afterward.
And Goldman's narrative is very much a denunciation of Davies' narrative. Davies' narrative is certainly cleaned up. You know, that's one of the major aspects of the Fab Four narrative. It does downplay the drug use from all four Beatles. It obviously, as I said before, definitely advocates for the band's friendship and for the necessity and equality of the Lennon-McCartney partnership. Goldman flat out states that that's all a fraud.
Yeah, he's totally the opposite. He's on the other end of the spectrum. Yeah.
Yes. And again, that's something to keep in mind when you're dealing with authors, is if another author comes up with an interpretation that is the complete polar opposite of yours, then for a lot of people, that means that you have to choose. And then you have to choose which interpretation you regard as more credible. So obviously, Davies would prefer that fans and readers regard his interpretation as more credible, certainly, than Albert Goldman's.
Yeah. This also might be a tangent, Aaron. And if it is, we don't have to get into it. But I was also thinking about the occasion, I think it was in the 80s, where after John was killed and... I can't think of the book that was written, but Paul was concerned that there was a lot of revisionist history going on with John being a martyr and his role being diminished and him being sort of the anti-hero in the whole kind of Beatle breakup mess. And he had contacted Davies and he kind of knew Davies sort of as a friend too. He and Lyndon, the kids, had vacationed with Davies and his family and this kind of thing. So he called Davies to complain, basically to sound off, and Davies had published that. And that struck me not only as a little disingenuous, but how does that kind of fit with how he presents himself as a Beatles biographer?
Yeah, the specifics of what you're talking about, that actually occurs. It does occur after the publication of Shout, but specifically it comes out after the interview Yoko gave Philip Norman, where we get the famous quote from Yoko, "John always said no one hurt him as much as Paul did."
Oh, right, right. Okay, yeah.
And so Paul attempted to call Norman, left a message, Norman never called back. Paul then called Davies. And that's when we get probably the most emotionally raw, it's not even really an interview.
Yeah.
Monologue.
Yeah.
From McCartney that you will get certainly until the time of Linda's death in 1998. So I don't think we ever really get a full explanation from Davies as to why he chooses to include that. I believe he includes that in the 1982 edition of the Offenbach biography.
Yeah.
I don't believe again that we ever get an explanation for why he includes it. I evidently, his perception was that it was fair game. So, and I'm sure there are journalists who would argue that it was, and there are presumably journalists who would argue that it was not.
Mm-hmm. But as a writer, I guess as a writer though, why, personally, there's a whole different way of looking at it. And I have my personal opinions about him doing it, but, and that aside, just for the purposes of our discussion, is he's always positioned himself as being, he wrote the only authorized biography, the most complete authorized biography, et cetera, et cetera. And then he reveals this very personal, intimate, raw interview or conversation that he had with Paul without Paul's permission. And he puts that in his next edition. So is that to kind of bolster his, I don't know, his standing as being in the, like, I have the goods. Like, I'm the one who knows. I'm not having to get it from other sources. I have a personal contact or a personal in, you know, in some kind of warped way. It just struck me as a really odd thing to do and to put it in that and publish it in that form.
Well, I think there could be a number of layers there in that, again, I'm not exactly clear on what the ethics or responsibilities of a journalist at that point in time are. Mm-hmm. But again, you do have perhaps the most emotionally revealing interview / conversation with Paul McCartney
ever.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Available up to that point in time, certainly, and possibly ever. And any journalist would know this is important information.
It's gold. Yeah. Yeah.
But also in addition to that, one of the elements again that you get from Hunter Davies is this reinforcement of and pushing of the Fab Four narrative and the version of events he offers in the authorized biography. And he pushes back diplomatically and subtly, but certainly pushes back in numerous interviews and in the forwards of his later editions and in his other works against the Shout narrative. Mm-hmm. So there's some criticism of Shout in that conversation from Paul.
Yes.
So, and one of the interesting elements of that is that Davies provided Norman with his notes from the authorized biography. And Norman used those in his research for Shout. He doesn't cite them, unfortunately, but they were made available to Norman. So again, there are various layers here. And again, if you agree with Norman's interpretation, then that undermines many of the interpretations and conclusions offered by Davies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting mix of how much did wanting to sell copies of the book mm-hmm. play into the element. How much of it was his relationship with Paul at that point in time? How much of it was Davies saying, my interpretation is preferable to Norman's interpretation?
Yeah. Yeah, especially a book that's been republished, or how many editions did we, five, six? All he can do is put new, how many editions has Davies' book had? Like, it's been out, how many? I'm trying to count how many times it went out. All you can do is update the introduction. You know, there's not much you can do other than that. Because he hasn't written, well, he's written, like you said, kind of more secondary minor kind of material. But this was really his big, his major work for sure about the Beatles.
Yes. And that's why in particular I paid attention to when we were prepping for this podcast. Let's, you know, compare and contrast much of what he's saying in the authorized biography with what he's saying decades later in the John Lennon letters, the commentary and interpretations he offered there.
Unfortunately, I haven't read that as far as I've read some of the extracts from the letters, but I've not read his introduction or any of his comments, Davies' comments, that is.
And maybe we'll have to do a podcast on that eventually.
Yeah,
because
just thinking that.
It is a very interesting book and reinforces a lot of things that he had said before. And it includes more of his interpretation analysis, obviously, of the breakup.
Okay. Yeah. Does that analysis venture farther afield than other analyses, or is it sort of in keeping with a certain, I'm just curious. It doesn't go as far as, you know, I don't imagine it would be like a Goldman thing, but does it seem, well, I'll read it. We'll know, but I was just curious whether it seemed kind of balanced or not.
Yeah, my reading is that it is quite balanced. Okay. And again, he's using his insight as someone who was an observer of the various Beatles and of the people they knew over months, if not years, to interpret and draw conclusions on, well, John said this, but he probably didn't mean it. And that's actually something Davies has said numerous times, is, of course, in the Lennon Remembers interview, as I mentioned, you have John criticizing the authorized biography, and Davies has said, well, I read that when John said it, and then I just laughed and said, well, that's just John being John.
Yeah. John now, has a reputation we know of just shooting up his mouth and saying what he feels without really kind of evaluating whether that's his actual belief. It may be how he feels at the time, but he revises as he goes along all the time. Yeah.
Right. And there's a level, obviously, of self-interest, and Davies would prefer that, but again, that's something that we have reinforcement for from May Pang and from Pete Shotton and from Ray Connolly and numerous other individuals, is that you can't regard any of John's statements as the end-all be-all of his thoughts or analysis on something. So probably my final issue to really delve into would be that element of reputation in regards to the authorized biography, because it is a book that, even when its reputation was significantly dented by the breakup and by the very swift emergence of the Lennon Remembers narrative and then of the Shout narratives, it is still a work that you see cited in really almost every Beatles book, or even if you don't see it cited because the book doesn't have citations, you see references to it or quotes from it. Mm-hmm. And even just the fact, as I mentioned, that Norman wanted Davies' notes indicates how important it was, how important it continues to be in historiography. So I guess what I'm saying is that even when its reputation wasn't pristine, people were still using the evidence in it.
Mm-hmm.
So then comes the issue of reputation and really where it stands now. Because we've seen, of course, the ebb and flow of Beatles historiography and of the varying narratives throughout Beatles historiography. And again, I think we started off this podcast and I was discussing my personal aversion to authorized biographies. Authorized history, excuse me. So I try not to let that tip the scales in my evaluation of works. I do believe Davies's work got unfairly dismissed because, again, of the timing. The publication in 1968, which turns it into a time capsule almost immediately, and maybe doesn't undermine a lot of his key interpretations, but basically shifts the Beatles from who they were with Davies as opposed to who they are in 1968
and 1969. Yeah. And they had changed so drastically from that point to 67 to 68. It's been huge. Like their change as in terms of as a group and as individuals was huge in that period from one year to the other.
Yes. So I do think it faced, again, an undeserved hit in reputation because Davies' interpretation, again, is the most comprehensive, most well-researched source that advocates for the Fab Four narrative. And then within 2 years, the Fab Four narrative is gone. It's erased.
Dead in the water. Yeah.
Yes. So adding that along with the element that you still have people using evidence for it, I do believe that the reputation of Davies' work has ebbed and flowed along with the various narratives in Beatles historiography. Again, with that caveat that I cannot get over, that it's an authorized biography. So we always have to deal with the question, is it essential in Beatles historiography? Has it been essential to Beatles historiography? And the answer to both is yes.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I wonder if Davies, probably, just legally, probably not, but he probably has a ton of notes that and information he didn't publish in the book because it was the authorized, like the drug taking and all the stuff we knew was going on in the Beatles' lives. I guess he would still be prohibited from publishing that just as a separate document or a separate book.
I don't know about the legal issues associated with that. I know Davies has discussed maybe not the notes, his Beatles notes, but he's discussed about how, of course, he had lyrics scribbled by John and Paul in his house and how his house was broken into. And it was after his house was broken into that he realized that the lyrics he had left over from this time period were worth more than the value of his house.
Oh, geez.
And that he was essentially inviting, for anyone who was in the know, burglars to come in and steal those lyrics. And so he donated them to the British Museum.
Wow. Yeah.
So I, again, don't know exactly where his notes are. I, again, know Norman got a hold of them. I assume other Beatles researchers and other biographers have been able to access them.
He's in a really unique position, you know, in terms of any biographer out there who's ever written about them.
Yes.
Like totally unique. Yeah. And a little precarious.
Yes. Absolutely terrifying.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Those are things I hadn't thought of. Just as insofar as just reading the book as a, back in the day as a fan and reviewing it now, you know, kind of as a more informed fan.
Right.
Yeah, there's so many layers to that.
And I am just extremely grateful that Davies approached McCartney, that Brian agreed to the authorized biography. One of the elements I always find very interesting is that Davies pitched the authorized biography to the Beatles as a sort of I'm trying to think of the proper word here, but basically if they were getting asked stupid questions by journalists, not really press conferences anymore because they weren't doing as nearly as many press conferences because they weren't touring. But if they kept getting asked the same questions over and over and over again, then Davey said, guess what? You can say, hey, look at our authorized biography. The answer is in there.
Oh, okay. Interesting. So that's one of the sales pitches he used to them and to Brian then.
Yes.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that Paul, I guess because Brian was their official kind of manager, but it seemed that Paul maybe was interested in the biography and said to Davies, you know, you have to pitch it to Brian. He kind of suggested padding his resume so that it would kind of appeal to Brian. So it sounded like Paul kind of wanted this to happen and suggested ways for Davies to make it happen to influence Brian Epstein.
That would be interesting to know what sort of reaction that would get today.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't know how he padded it, but that's what he said. He kind of like, you know, kind of make it sound better. You know how you do in a resume, you kind of say things in a certain way that sounds a little more kind of impressive, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Just don't get too fictitious.
That's right. Yeah, keep it honest, just a little embellished. So, Erin, do we have anything more we want to add about our review of this book?
Oh, probably my final thought would be in regards to the authorized biography, that it's the last time we really get all four Beatles speaking with the same voice and all of them advocating the major elements of the Fab Four narrative. And I think that's crucial because so much changes in real life from 1967 to 1968. Some people leave the story. Some people come into the story. I wouldn't say it's the most influential source of the Fab Four narrative. I would argue that the most influential single source of the Fab Four narrative is actually A Hard Day's Night. But it's certainly the most comprehensive. And again, because Davies was embedded with them for so long, that does grant it a level of weight as opposed to an interview that took space over a few hours or a day or two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's no other book like it in that respect.
No.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's, again, why it was so hard to find comparative works to it. You have certain works that have certain similarities to it, but nothing on this level of the authorized biography.
Yeah. So it would be a book that if someone hasn't a neophyte in the Beatle fandom, or even if someone who's a seasoned fan, it'd be a book that we would recommend that they read.
Absolutely.
If they haven't already. And probably to read later versions that have all the introductions, the different introductions, because that's a whole gold mine. It's a gold mine of information, the introductions. Yeah. A landmine too, depending on your point of view. Okay, so Erin, I think we can conclude there and thank our listeners for staying tuned to another hour of our review of a really important Beatle biography.
All right. Thank you, everybody.
See you next time. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please visit us at our blog at www.beatlebiorereview.wordpress.com.